Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly audiovisual podcast brought to you by the magazine Free Minds and Free Markets. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu-Ward. Welcome back, A-Team.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
That's right. We're going to dive straight into issue of contention, Washington's war on TikTok, here in a moment. But first, friends, do the price fluctuations of crypto make you seasick? Are you suspicious of the long-term reliability of the index funds and blue chip stocks dominating your 401k? Well, CSN Mint has got some shiny silver coins for you to consider adding to your investment mix. CSN Mint, one of the most trusted names in the numismatic arts, has been providing certified U.S. Mint collectible coins and precious metals for over 20 years. They're particularly bullish right now on silver, which is trading for far below its all-time high, despite having plenty of modern industrial applications in electronics, solar panels, medical devices, and such like. CSN Mint can get you your coins, your bullion bars, your collectibles, all with certificates of authentication graded by a third-party professional for purity and origin. If you're going to collect something, it might as well be money. So go to csnmint.com/roundtable and use the promo code roundtable to get a free silver American Eagle. That's a $30 value right there with your purchase of $75 or more. That's csnmint.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay. Last week, the House of Representatives voted 352-65 to force ByteDance, the red Chinese parent company of the wildly popular video app TikTok, to sell off its U.S. operations to an American firm by September, or TikTok will be banned in the United States and America. It took just 8 days from the bill's introduction to get the thing passed, which is a little bit fast for Washington. President Joseph Robinette Biden II has indicated that he would like to sign such a bill, but don't quite pop those champagne bottles just yet. Josh Hawley, or should I say sparkling wine, American sparkling wine bottles, because the Senate might kick this thing down to the Commerce Committee, which would gum up the works considerably. And there are plenty of powerful people who are aligned against the bill, including a flip-flopping Donald Trump and Tucker Carlson, as well as Reason's own Robbie Suave. Catherine, I've seen a lot of kind of ambient irritation at libertarians about this issue, saying that we tend to be naive, and what part about having the CCP have access to all your teenagers' data, don't you understand, kind of thing. So can you explain slowly, perhaps, to skeptics of our broad position, if we have one, what is our position, and why are we all soft on commies?
Yeah, I mean, my position, at least, I would certainly not presume to speak for all libertarians on this topic in particular, which is oddly scrambling people's into it. Like, the number of people who have shown up in my Twitter feed or in my inbox with roughly the same take that I have on this issue that I did not expect to see there, it's been a weird one. Like, Current Affairs out here with a good take on this recently. That was one. And so...
That's just because they're soft on the Chi-Coms.
They're soft on the Chi-Coms, and so am I. I love Chi-Coms for their own commercial activities.
I'm definitely clipping that.
I love Chi-Coms. Just put it on a bumper sticker.
It's going to go on TikTok.
So, right. The position here is there are a few different parts. The most fundamental one is that this is a speech issue and a free association issue. These are platforms that people are using to do all kinds of speech, including political speech. We should be very, very wary of Congress acting to restrict places where people speak about Congress, among other things. Second, this is no one is forced to use TikTok. And that is a very, very important part of this conversation that weirdly gets left out. You don't have to be on TikTok. You, as a parent, can tell your child not to be on TikTok. You can take away their phone. You can block TikTok from your router. You can do all kinds of stuff. Parents have tools to keep their children off of TikTok if that is what we are concerned about, because, of course, we are absolutely sort of mixing together in a kind of indeterminate stew the for the children argument with the commies are manipulating our elections arguments in ways that make both arguments extremely unproductive. So the commies are manipulating our elections argument. Really not strong evidence that that is happening. Of course, there is censorship by the platform itself of the content that appears on TikTok. That is true of every platform. We have every
equally
platform.
True. Equally what? True.
I mean, there is no clear evidence that it is more true or more perniciously true on TikTok than it is on other platforms. And again, if it is true, feel free to not use TikTok. If you don't want the Chinese to have your data, cool, don't use it. I just kind of keep coming back to that. We should not try to beat the Chinese by being more like the Chinese. This is my final point. Like, you know who's super awesome at restricting foreign platforms that, you know, encourage free discourse and might be classed under the category of social media? China. China does this to maintain control of their citizens. We should not emulate them in this. They are not the way we want to go here. The fact that we have, you know, some of the biggest anti-China fearmongers also saying, well, China does it, so we have to do it too. That is exactly the wrong approach. That will always be the wrong approach.
Peter, you understand the technology and also like to film yourself doing dances to Taylor Swift songs. Can you walk us through some of the details of the bill, the finer print, and what the actual legislation would do?
Yeah, so basically what this bill does is it says that if a social media type company, and there's a bunch of carve outs for actually things that it doesn't cover, certain types of commerce, that sort of thing. But a social media type company like this, if it is owned by a corporation that is headquartered, located, and has strong ties to a foreign adversary nation, which is an official designation by the President of the United States, it may have to divest itself, and cannot, you know, like you can't have that ownership structure. And so this is, I think, one of the big concerns. Catherine already mentioned the constitutional speech issues here. That's a big deal. But the other thing here is that this empowers the president in many ways to basically decide which social media companies can and cannot operate in the United States. Now, yes, there's a review process. This is not a completely new power on the part of the president. There's already a foreign adversary designation that exists. But this is something that libertarians who are correctly concerned about the CCP and correctly concerned about the CCP's access to TikTok data. That's something that I actually think is at least a legitimate thing to worry about. In order to combat that, this bill is going to empower the U.S. president basically to have the power to ban social media apps, right? And that's one of the reasons I think we're seeing folks like Elon Musk, like Tucker Carlson, some of these folks who are maybe, you know, sometimes, as Catherine said, there is a delightful coalition of weirdos who have come out against this bill. And one of the reasons is that those weirdos value their ability to speak online. And they see that, well, you can go after TikTok, maybe you can go after Twitter or X or whichever platform you don't like next. I mean, there's really a kind of, in political coalition terms, this thing is like a midnight drunk dinner at Denny's. You know, it's just totally scrambled. And that's kind of delightful.
Oh, my God, I hate it.
That is so bad.
Those dinners are terrible. On the other hand, I've had a lot of
Denny's on Sunset. That's fine. Nick, are the fears that underlie all this stuff that people are expressing, are they valid concerns? I mean, is it
I don't think so. No, I mean, and partly because the question about the data is, you know, didn't we force ByteDance to sequester U.S. data via Oracle and things like that. So, you know, if that was successful, that's been taken care of. And even that is dubious. But then the other question is, you know, there's two for me. One is like, okay, so TikTok is slowly, and you hear people talk about this, that they're slowly changing the algorithm so that American kids are stupid. You know, they're doing dances instead of, 10-dimensional calculus or something like everybody in China is doing. And they're bleaching out anything that's critical of China, maybe, but although you can still find Tiananmen Square, protest stuff on TikTok. I did that over the weekend. And it's
just
not clear.
Dance.
Yeah, it is a dance. It's called the Bagman dance. But there's those questions which seem to be completely ridiculous. TikTok is still a super vibrant, platform for all kinds of speech. And then the other thing for me, there's what to me tips us to understand we are in a social media panic is that even people like Elise Stefanik, the Harvard grad, who's one of the co-sponsors of all this stuff, constantly in her comments is shifting back and forth between this is a critical threat to our national security. And then she's always slipping into, oh, but it's also, so that should be its own thing, right? That somehow China is going to figure out what dance moves are really powerful and then use them against Americans. And then she's always slipping into, and it's poisoning the minds of our next generation. So it's like, what is it? Is it that we need to ban TikTok because it is apparatus? It's, the Communist International in the 21st century, and it's completely run by the Chinese government, and it's fucking us up that way, or it is turning our children into mush. Because it doesn't seem like that second one, then talking about who owns it, doesn't seem to be what Congress would be talking about. To me, this is just the worst kind of hysteria. It's weird in an election year that it is getting, massive bipartisan support. And that should be deeply worrying to everybody because this, this passed the House with what, like 50 or 60 dissenting votes. And it was a mix of Republicans and Democrats. But this, when consensus starts to form, you understand what the real argument is. And this is about social media panic. It has nothing to do with China. It has everything to do with the adults feeling like they're no longer able to control the conversation, the political adults. And to back up Catherine's point, it's just that like, if you're a parent and you don't like your kid being on TikTok that much, don't let them be on TikTok that much. That really is the answer.
Yeah. A couple of years ago, Elizabeth Nolan Brown and I did a panel about tech regulation and why, even if you are concerned about China's links to ByteDance, for example, banning TikTok, which, Trump tried to do via an executive order, is not a good idea. And after the panel, there was a guy who came up to us and said with a totally straight face, he was not exaggerating, that he was much more worried about TikTok than about nuclear war. And he was just like went on about this, about how TikTok was too. So much more powerful a tool for fighting and another country and for destroying their minds than nuclear war would be. And it's just crazy and it makes people crazy. And you see that just in some of the rhetoric about how TikTok is digital fentanyl, right? Which is just, I recently had a medical procedure, by the way, in which I had the opportunity to have actual fentanyl in my blood for a little while. And I'll just say I'm really glad they didn't give me TikTok.
Yeah. And I do want to follow up on an earlier suggestion from a previous episode that we start calling heroin analog TikTok.
You know what? I think the important thing
here
is
we want to take it seriously, we'll do that.
At Reason, we want to legalize both digital and analog fentanyl. And that's the hill we're going to die on, maybe literally.
Catherine, speaking of hills and dying, although it's not speaking of either, your ex-girlfriend Nikki Haley did a pretty interesting whiplash maneuver when she was still running for president, which is to say 10 years ago, she was waving the red Chinese to come in to invest in South Carolina when she was governor of the state. And now she's, lauding various bans on the Chinese government owning industries or purchasing things. Should there be prohibitions on Chinese companies or Chinese government owned companies investing in critical infrastructure or even farms in America? What's your line of like, I don't want the Chi-Coms to own this?
I mean, this is not a new thing, right? I'm old enough to remember when we were worried about the Japanese owning our ports. And then also when we were worried about the Saudis owning our ports. And then also,
Ports World. Yes.
Dubai the Ports World. Emirates. Remember? Yeah. Remember that?
We're still worried about the Japanese owning U.S. steel, apparently.
That's true. And
this exactly. is the solution, by the way, is to force the Japanese to buy TikTok.
Right. So first of all, yes, TikTok to Japan solves all of our problems. In fact, let's just sell TikTok to the Japanese steel company that we're trying to prevent from doing a deal with U.S. Steel. So I think that the answer here is that almost always somewhere at the root of these debates, in addition to kind of your just baseline, you know, uncritical, buy American kind of xenophobic energy that like animates a lot of this, there's almost always some kind of cronyist interest as well. And I want to point out that like as this bill was passing, all of a sudden there were a bunch of news stories about how former Treasury Secretary Steve, and I can never say his last name and I refuse to learn in Matt Welch style, Mnuchin. Is
Batman versus Superman producer
putting together
Steve Mnuchin
an investment group to buy TikTok. And that just seems to me like this is why people hate capitalism, because they think this is what capitalism is. And in fact, this is what government interference in the economy is. But like always somewhere in these deals, somewhere in this fear of having a foreign corporation own something or part of something here in the United States, there is some kind of cronyist interest at stake. You know, you can look, scratch below the surface. It's always there. Listen, the goals of a Japanese steel company and a U.S. steel company should be the same. They should be well aligned in virtually all instances. And in the rare cases when they are not, the U.S. Congress and its, you know, lackey in the form of former Treasury secretaries is not going to do a better job of aligning those incentives.
All right. Last week, California's absolutely cursed high-speed rail project, allegedly connecting Los Angeles to San Francisco one of these decades. The head of it told lawmakers in Sacramento that he's going to need another $100 billion.
Is that a lot?
Of taxpayer money before a single choo-choo rings its whistle or something. Sticklers for detail may recall that the original price tag on the project back when the first bond measure was passed by California voters was supposed to be a $33 billion. They had already quadrupled that at the very least. I don't have all the numbers in front of me, but it's certainly that. And that's before the $100 billion. It feels like, Nick, that there are some public policy lessons in this story that might have a broader application even to California, but I know that you know a lot about California. Do you have some thoughts about this project?
Yeah, it's first off, the slow motion suck that this is on California taxpayers is amazing. In 2015, I wrote an article for the Daily Beast about True Detective Season 2, which it was the most libertarian show on TV. And actually that whole HBO at the time was the Sunday night lineup was True Detective Season 2, Veep, and The Brink, a show which was like a dark version of Get Smart about how fucked up and stupid American foreign policy, particularly in Afghanistan, was. It was kind of amazing. But True Detective Season 2 was Vince Vaughn's character is trying to get in on what everybody agrees is just the massive grift of the high-speed California rail project. And that was like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Right. And it just keeps kind of, I would say, keeps chugging along, except like nothing is moving on it. And the one thing that I want to call attention to for people, I talked to Annie Duke, author of Quit, the former poker player who wrote a book a year or two ago called Quit. And in it, she discusses how there's a thing called when you have tough engineering problems or tough business problems to come up with, there's a concept that was pioneered by a guy at Google named Astro Teller, who talked about monkeys and pedestals. And he said, you know, like, let's say you want to do an act where you have a chainsaw juggling monkey who stands on a pedestal in Times Square. And you want to do that. You want to put that act together. And it's like, okay, well, it's really hard to train the monkey to juggle chainsaws. So let's start with the pedestals. And we're going to build a bunch of pedestals because we can get that done. But it's like, it doesn't matter. You can build great pedestals and multiple pedestals until you get the fucking monkey to be able to juggle. You've got nothing. And she talked about that in the context of the California high-speed rail problem, because beyond everything else, and they have really barely laid any track in anything, but everything they've done is the pedestal part of the project, where they're laying track in inland California on flat areas where even that has proven to be impossible to do without massive cost overruns. And they have not even figured out the engineering of getting over the mountains in Southern California and Northern California to connect to the Bay Area and LA, which means that everything that they're doing now is never going to work because they have not even addressed the actual hard part of the project. And Astro Teller, this Google Skunkworks genius, is like, when you have a monkey and pedestal problem, you have to start with the monkey because the pedestals like don't matter. It's the monkey. And like California just hasn't even come close to licking all of that. So it's mind-boggling. And it is amazing that Jerry Brown was so hard, you know, he had such a hard on for this project and he knew it was bullshit. And this is a guy who at various points in his life was a real cost-cutting, you know, penny-wise governor. And he laid into this again and again. And then Gavin Newsom, when he came into office, he had the perfect opportunity to say, you know what, this was a great idea, but it's not our future. And the fact that he didn't, it makes you think there is something going on in California where like, there must be the worst cache of blackmail photos from whoever is building this railroad on politicians, because it just it's a project that can never be finished and never be successful. And yet it continues to kind of ooze out slowly, you know, soaking up more and more California taxpayer dollars.
Steve Mnuchin is putting together a group of investors.
Yeah.
Right as we speak to take over this project. No problem. Don't worry.
The Peter, I remember you, juggling monkey of American transportation policy.
The next Reason Foundation public policy paper. I look forward to reading it.
The long ago, far away, Peter, you wrote a piece, I think it was during the botched Obamacare rollout, about how government's really, really bad at IT, like colossally bad at IT projects. Are rail projects the IT of rail?
Well, I hadn't thought about it that way, but it makes a lot of sense. These are both complex engineering projects that are difficult under any circumstances. And just kind of inherently, the government is not going to hire the best people and is not going to create the best conditions for them to do high quality work. And you see that in California with the rail project, with all of the environmental review. And this has been a huge problem for California's high-speed rail. It's not just that it's a hard engineering problem. It's that the environmental review, which is a separate thing from doing the building and figuring out how to get that monkey to juggle the chainsaws over the mountain on the train, the environmental review is just taking years and years and years and adding billions and billions of dollars. And this is one of the interesting things, I think, about American politics right now, is that this is happening in conjunction with a mostly center-left versus left conversation about building costs generally, specifically with regard to home prices and home building. But a big part of the argument that the abundance agenda liberals are making right now is that, well, it's too hard to build things. We've made it too hard to build. It's too slow. And one of the big reasons why is that all of the environmental review, all of the opportunities for environmental groups to just block these projects, right? And this is, again, it's mostly in the context of home projects, but it's true of rail as well. And there is a kind of interesting split right now that's happening on the American left and center left between the folks who think that the environmentalists are just making it really impossible to do anything, and the environmentalists who are like, yes, we are, and that's good.
I mean, that might be an interesting intellectual split, but isn't the facts on the ground that, you know, the abundance chin strokers lose all the time and have no power?
I don't know that they lose all the time and have no power. They certainly are not doing a great job of fending off the environmentalists on projects like this. They a lot of the time they talk about transportation projects in addition to the housing stuff, right? This is about, you know, walkable cities, dense urban areas, that sort of thing. And you see, you know, Gavin Newsom in California has said, well, you know, we're going to pass some zoning reforms. We're going to make it a little easier to build. We're going to try and get rid of some of that and speed up some of these projects. At the same time, you have this absolutely interminable California high-speed rail project that has been going on forever, is now going to be, what, 8, 9-10 times, not quite 10 times the budget that was initially announced. But once they ask for another $100 billion, which they will eventually, it'll be 10 times. I mean, this is, it just reminds me of that incredible Onion segment from, I don't know, 10, 20 years ago, back when the Onion was doing fake cable news panels. And there was one that was like, in the know, should the government keep dumping money into a giant hole? And
that was the best segment they ever made.
And California's answer is like a resounding yes.
Catherine, can we send you to California and just have you yell afuera over and over again?
Absolutely.
And or what's what? It feels like there's so many different things to take away from all of this that are all kind of infuriating. What's yours?
I guess my big takeaway here is with respect to the California government in particular, the thing they should embrace is don't try. Like, just
give up.
Give up.
Treat high speed rail like this podcast.
Just
speak
give
for
up.
Yourself, sir.
But truly, they're like, things perhaps the governments can do, though I'm skeptical. Rail projects aren't one of them. Like, we just aren't good at that. And this should just be a kind of a category thing. There are many, many other things that California would like to do that they should also not do. But we could just start with the obvious low-hanging, like, we've wasted enough. Bail out now. And other states should take notice as well. Don't try. Don't try to do this. We have cars.
I mean, try to greenlight a project.
We have planes. We have cars. We're going to have
actually bid it out and not have the government build it or control it, as what just happened in Florida, right?
Yes. So Florida Bright Line is an interesting counterexample for sure. But even there, that's a best case scenario. Like, very excited about that whole project. And still, did we need it? Did we, though? Unclear.
The Bright Line, the company that did the high-speed Florida line, is also, they've gotten the approvals to go from L.A. to Las Vegas, which, and it's going to end up, of course, having government money and, various kinds of either hard or soft subsidies involved. But that will be interesting to see if they can pull it off, because part of it is California is a more complex state, topographically, but also politically, as Peter was alluding to.
My lesson for this is that, and this was an early disillusioning or midlife disillusioning lesson, is that the political class of people really suck and shouldn't be taken very seriously. We quoted in our most recent piece, and we've quoted over the years, the rather amazing editorial from the Los Angeles Times, where I used to work in the editorial shop there, that when was first considering the ballot initiative about this project, quoted the very extensive and very well done Reason Foundation policy analysis of this, and basically said they may very well be right. That's hard to say for some reason. But it's more persuasive what they say, but we should do it anyways. And they kept coming back to that. And so did, I think, the New York Times editorial board. Like, yeah, sure, the costs have tripled and quadrupled. But man, trains are neat. That's not serious, people. Libertarians are oftentimes portrayed as the absolute crazy people in the room, and they're not serious about governance and blah, 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 blah. Like, all of that is some of the most fundamentally unserious, childlike way of dealing with things. And then you'll occasionally get a quote from honest, corrupt politicians like Willie Brown in California saying, yeah, of course, initial price tags are meant to be completely unrealistically low. And then the thing is, you just start digging. And then once you start digging, you have to keep going, or else, you get that buy-in. And here we go. And it's, you have all this guaranteed government money. No. Don't tell me that, we are undergoing austerity. We've cut to the bone when you still do stuff like this and you still engage in that kind of magical thinking having to do with this. It's really, really discrediting, disreputable. You see this on a local and state base is mostly local to this day, with stadium construction constantly. Just absolutely magical thinking, BS about all the jobs this is going to create, and it's going to be no taxpayer money except for the $758 billion that, or million dollars that we have to throw into it. It's garbage science, and there's no excuse for anyone not to know that now. They're just lying to you to take your money, to give it to their rich friends, and to be there at the ribbon cutting ceremony. It's theft. It's theft.
Anyways. I have a theory, which I just developed right now while you were talking, and it might not work. Does this happen? Is this phenomenon more prevalent in things that are jobs that small boys dream of having? Train conductor, sports baller, police or firefighter. There might be something here. What else do small boys want to be? Astronaut? I don't know, guys. I feel like I might have found it.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And what's interesting, because this is, I am sick of like the Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, like, damn it, when I was 12 years old on the cusp of puberty, I was promised a jetpack. Where's my jetpack? We don't do anything good anymore because we haven't delivered on a jetpack. Joe Biden, who is in his second, third, or fourth childhood, obviously, or about to enter it, big train guy.
Loves ice cream.
The sports, the edifice complex, you know, is real. It's magnificent, and it's a complete waste of time and resources and energy, and it never pays off. I think you may have elucidated the actual atavistic urge that's behind so much of dumb politics today, Catherine.
This isn't just a local problem for Californians, though. This is also something that has been federally funded. And in fact, the $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure law that Joe Biden signed, there were Republican votes on this one. It's the bipartisan infrastructure law. They threw $3 billion at California high-speed rail last year, allocated that. And that, so that means that this deficit-financed infrastructure law is going to be going towards building infrastructure that may never exist.
Construction worker. It's another one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
it would be great. Maybe they could just build like a skate park that goes from LA to San Francisco. It would be easier, cheaper, and it would kind of scratch many of the same itches.
It'd be totally
cost a lot of money to put sand over that during the next pandemic.
Yeah, that's true. So that's true. Yeah.
Got to watch out for that. All right. We're going to get to our listener questions of the week here in a moment. But first, friends, do you ever drink a lot of like alcohol? For instance, on a Sunday night, like maybe even on St. Patrick's Day, with just spitballing here, Michael Moynihan, before you have to go to work early Monday morning and tape a podcast that's now videotaped. Well, if you plan such a not necessarily great evening correctly, you can wake up the next morning feeling fresh as a baby's mind. That is, if you use ZBiotics. ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. ZBiotics produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make ZBiotics your first drink of the night, then drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. Just go to zbiotics.com/roundtable right now to get 15% off your first order. When you use the promo code roundtable at checkout, there's a 100% money back guarantee if you are unsatisfied in any way. No questions asked. That's zbiotics.com/roundtable, promo code roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder to email your queries to roundtable@reason.com. Email number one comes from Ken Cowan, who writes, "Hey, y'all, I'm an adult convert to libertarian thinking, and I have a question I haven't quite been able to figure out. What is the difference between small L libertarians and big L libertarians? From context, I think that small L libertarians are those who have libertarian principles but don't really care about the Libertarian Party. And big L libertarians are those that have the Libertarian Party and its goals as their focus. Is that pretty much it? Is there more to it than that? Clarification would be appreciated." I'm just going to quickly answer this question because there's no such thing as a silly question, or at least there's no such thing as a question that Matt hasn't asked in ignorance in the past. In this case, Virginia Pastrell, the first time she was nice enough to take me out to lunch, like in 2001, I was like, well, it's a libertarian. And she,
that sounded like a silly question, Matt.
She might have be paraphrasing here, but she differentiated between a small L and large L. And yes, it's basically that. It's a way of while you're speaking as opposed to writing, because you can indicate while writing that when you're talking about libertarianism, you're not necessarily talking about the party. That's it. And small L's tend to be talking and thinking more about the broader tendency. And I don't know if anyone has anything else to add on that. Otherwise, I'll go to listener question number two.
Only cocktail parties, no political parties.
Yes. Okay, this one comes from Julian Lafleur, whose name, I think, translates to Julian the Flower. He writes, in part, hello, Roundtablers, first a comment, as this was the first time I've actually gone to look things up on your website. That shouldn't be the last time, Julian Lafleur. I was surprised to see your pictures. The only one of you who looks like your voice, which goes to show how little my oral perception has in common with real life, is Catherine. Okay, good to know. So what the second the
lies question. You lie, Julian Lafleur.
Lena Khan, Julian Lafleur writes, our charmingly aggressive FTC chair, that's the Federal Trade Commission, seems to see collusion in every corner, monopolies in every mop closet, and higher prices in every high-rise. Yet she does not even consider the most pernicious of oligopolies, the Republicans and Democrats, each of which controls far more of the market than a slacker like Amazon could ever hope to achieve. They are more effective at locking out competition than any puny merger between JetBlue and Spirit could ever be. And they cause more damage to our communal welfare than Walmart could hope to cause by undercutting all the corner stores between here and Kalamazoo. What say you, Catherine? Your visage was referenced. You go first.
But do it in a funny voice. Just to scramble Julian LaFleur's jets.
My brand is so consistent. I even sound like I look. This is exactly right. Like both of today's listener questions, the answer is like, preach. Hell yeah. Nailed it. We've talked about this, I think, a couple weeks ago, that it is truly the political parties behave in exactly the way that like a cartoon villain for the anti-monopolist or antitrust movement would describe. And yet somehow it's like, I'm blind. I can't see that one. That's an invisible monopoly. I can't see it. A duopoly, I suppose. I can't see it at all. I still don't think actually that, you know, Lena Khan should break up the political parties either. That's not the way. Yeah.
Peter, if I may, the political parties are breaking themselves up, though. Matt Welch, you may remember a book titled The Declaration of Independence. And the insight that began that fantastic journey, which is still ongoing, was that duopolies dominate markets. We use the particular example of Fujifilm and Kodak for film in the world. They dominate that until they no longer do. And what we are witnessing in the political arena is, basically historic lows for both the Republican and Democratic Party in terms of self-identification. They're down in the mid-20s and will continue to go further down until they reconstitute themselves as organizations that can pull more of a consensus among people. The difference, of course, between private duopolies that go out of business and the political ones is that they have guaranteed money. So they may never go away, but what they stand for and the respect or the attention and the devotion of people that they command can get bigger. I mean, there could be a time 50 years ago, 49% of Americans considered themselves Democrats. That was because the Democratic Party stood for something different. And that was more representative of what people wanted. It's not necessarily a good thing, but, duopolies, either they change or they disappear. And I think we're in a glorious moment where the parties have continued to decline over the course of the 21st century. And our function now as small L libertarians, as big L libertarians, Democrats, Republicans, you name it, is to force them to change into something that is more meaningful and representative of where the country should be going.
One of the interesting factlets that I've stumbled across this election cycle is that since I think it's even as recently as 2008, but maybe 2004, certainly over the last 20 years, to the extent that we measure people's political party affiliation, which we do in 30 or so states, the number of people who are registered independents, which includes me, has grown from 25 million or 24 million to 35 million. And while the number of registered Republicans has largely stayed the same, it's around 35 million. So it will probably cross. Independents will outnumber registered Republicans in those 30 states. Democrats are up around, I think, 45 million. Peter, you love Lina Khan, right? So what do you say?
Yeah, I think the questioner is correct. Of course, Lina Khan is not interested in breaking up political party monopolies because the thing that she is trying to do is grab more power for the government. That is a core part of her worldview, and the neo-Brandeisian hipster antitrust movement is in some sense about taking control of or exerting influence over large, successful, influential organizations that have cultural and economic power where they don't. And the antitrust movement is fundamentally about gaining more power for the government and for bureaucrats. And that's why Lina Khan is not interested in political power, because she wants more of it. And she wants the bureaucrats and the expert class of people who didn't build anything to have more power and more control over things that are important and successful in American life.
Nick, I know that you and Matt love the independents, but I recently learned from, I think, Politico about a new category or a newish category, the double haters.
Double haters, yeah.
Yeah.
Double haters.
No,
those are my people. One-fifth.
I'm in for that, except it doesn't go far enough. Yeah,
one-fifth of the electorate currently polling as double haters, and myself among them. These are, of course, people who hate both candidates and both parties and would really rather not.
One historical irony or paradox, I've lost faith in my definition of irony, is that the antitrust, and this is also spelled out in at least one entire chapter in the aforementioned book, the antitrust concept was used a lot in the 1970s to analyze government. Because if you're going to be talking about you're anti-competitively rigging a market and in such a way that favors the incumbent rather than the consumer, where else might you apply that analysis? And it was a lot of left of center economists, Alfred Kahn among them and others, who said, let's use this to begin the process of deregulating airlines and trucking and beer and a bunch of other things besides. We sorely need to remember that line of argument. If you don't like monopolies, if you really think that there's a media monopoly out there, I think people don't really even say that anymore, thank God. But other people are always constantly trying to break up these horrible oligopolies and monopolies. Then you really should be wary of the government running stuff and also doing it in such a way that they make illegal competitors to government. That's kind of should where your approach should be first. And we've absolutely lost that. And it's a damn shame. That's what I'm going to say. All right, Catherine, Nick was throwing shade at Elon Musk. And that's fine. He's a guy who needs a lot more shade because he'll get skin cancer otherwise. But last week, I'm pretty sure he did a really big rocket. And you must have been excited. And I saw some video of it and it looked super big, that rocket. About little boys and getting excited. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about that moment and how it turned your hair a new shade of lavender?
Elon Musk did a big rocket. That's a very, very accurate summary of what happened. He had tried to do this big rocket two times before this time, and the rockets went boom. This one also did... have an unscheduled rapid disassembly, which is their preferred term, but only after 50 minutes of flight, including a bunch of very interesting successes. This is the vehicle that Elon Musk wants to use to like go forth into the galaxy. So this is, it's a big deal. There are four more of these that he's already built, just like hanging out, waiting for their turn. And I just think like the sheer volume that SpaceX is working at right now, like just the number of launches, the number of vehicles that they are churning out, is really underappreciated, even by people who are like, oh, I saw there was a launch. That's cool. Like the US government built nothing for a very long time. And before that, they built like a couple of space shuttles at a time. Like they could barely keep the pieces glued onto. SpaceX is doing something so fundamentally different. It's very, very cool. This was the heaviest object ever put into space, I think. The largest, heaviest vehicle. I was very excited. It was very cool.
SpaceX
for letting me have time to be excited.
SpaceX is training the monkey to juggle the chainsaws.
That's actually not right. Like Elon was like, great, we will start with the chainsaw monkeys and we'll figure out the rest later. And I'll be damned if we don't have a bunch of monkeys that only cut off their heads with chainsaws sometimes now. We're going to get better at it, though, those monkeys.
Doesn't that like cost a lot of money, Catherine? Is he just like, is he burning money faster than Steve?
That's what your $8 on Twitter, Matt, is going to.
It's your $8
your check mark is paying for this. Yeah. It does cost a lot of money. He has a lot of money, but also people are paying him a lot of money to put their satellites in orbit. There's a whole industry there. There's a whole money-making thing happening. Also, of course, the U.S. government is a customer of SpaceX, so he does get some government money. And I know that people like to be mad at that, and I'm mad at it a little bit, but I'm willing to overlook that that small error in judgment.
All right, let's get to our end of podcast, what we have all been consuming in the cultural arena. Nick, do you want to lead us off?
Yeah, I watched the first season of Feud, which is subtitled Betty and Joan, because it's about Betty Davis and Joan Crawford filming Whatever Happened to Baby Jane in the early 60s. And these are the two biggest stars in Hollywood for decades, who were at the end of their careers or in career lulls when this movie came out, which is a camp classic and is kind of like an urtext of boomer irony and camp. The whole series is fantastic. I watched it partly because the second season dropped earlier, which has to do with what's his name? Truman Capote and a bunch of New York Society dames that he hung out with, which is also fantastic. But the feud Betty and Joan is incredible because it really takes a legendary feud and then plays it through the making of this movie where their careers cross. It's the only movie that they made together. And I want to call out and it was directed by Robert Aldrich, a fantastic director who's kind of considered a true auteur, because he was always kind of a B-level director, and he left his stamp on kind of shitty studio-assigned scripts for the most part and things like that. But there is a sequence which everybody should see, which has to do with Joan Crawford after this movie, after a couple of years after Baby Jane came out. Her career never really resurrected, and she was reduced to doing a movie called Trog, where she plays an anthropologist who finds a caveman. It was originally called The Missing Link. And she was also writing an etiquette book at the same time. This was around 1970. And there's a sequence of her going through the humiliation of working for a Z-level movie in England called Trog. Look it up. It is one of the greatest shitty movies of all time, with her doing book signings for her etiquette book while the Doors song The End plays. And it blows away the Apocalypse Now version of that and even the Chris Elliott Eagleheart version in an episode of that TV show. It is everything that television should be, which is mostly a meta commentary on TV and celebrity culture. I highly recommend The Feud, Betty and Joan, particularly that episode and that sequence.
I'm just realizing now, because I watched the original, I guess, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, whatever, the Gene Wilder picture with my daughter after we'd seen Wonka. And the Mike TV character, that was played by Nick Gillespie. Nick Gillespie is Mike TV.
Yeah.
It's all meta commentary. It looks like
Also, by the way, I believe that we are living in a world of Veruca Salt. That is the problem with today. You know, when they say the future is female, they meant that we live in a world of Veruca Salt.
That is some grade A misogyny, and I'm all here for it. Catherine,
I don't know about the Veruca Salt part, but we're definitely living in a Willy Wonka world. They're the number one ranked cocktail bar in North America right now is basically making Willy Wonka's everlasting gobstoppers that taste like whole meals, right? So their whole, it's a bar called Double Chicken Please in New York. And their whole concept is that all of their cocktails are made to taste like complete meal items. So they have like Waldorf salad and cold pizza. And those are cocktails. And it's like a little fancy cocktail that they've like scienced up in a back room somewhere. And you drink it and you're like, what?
I think
like
you just convinced
pizza?
Me to what? Do terrorism for the first time now, of, or at least vandalism. My God, that sounds atrocious. Catherine,
delicious.
What did you consume?
I'm just happy that Peter intervened so I don't have to reply directly to Nick's Veruca Salt's claims. I read, finally, Jennifer Burns's book about Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman, The Last Conservative. I really enjoyed her Ayn Rand biography, Low, those many years ago. And the Milton Friedman book is also good. Our own Brian Doherty reviewed it for Reason Magazine, and I did read the review before reading the book, so it perhaps biased me. I do think his criticism is fair, that it's right there in the title, by sort of explaining his significance through the lens of the conservative movement, you miss some of the really important stuff about his thought, which is that he was a libertarian. Not only a conservative, although maybe also a conservative, depending on how you want to filter those terms. But, you know, I already love me some Uncle Milton, and this book gave me a lot more to love, so much to love in a 5-foot-tall package. And I'm looking forward to whatever Jennifer Burns does next. I will read that one as well. I think she's just like a really good, her archival work is really good. She writes like good, clear prose, and her choice of subjects is impeccable. So Milton Friedman, The Last Conservative by Jennifer Burns. I am late to the game, but the book is very good for those of us who have an interest in the subject matter.
And I will recommend Nick Gillespie's interview with Jennifer Burns about that book.
Absolutely,
which
yes.
I was lucky enough to attend in person. And
it's a really good book, and I agree, Catherine. She's just one of the most interesting biographers, you know, of the broadly defined right. The Ayn Rand book is great, and this one is phenomenal as a cultural history too of, you know, the topics that really, you know, that Friedman tackled and kind of won on.
And there's so many. Just so many passing quotes in this book that just make me weep because no one would say or productively hear those words on the American right today. I mean, just like casually, you know, capital flowing freely across borders and everyone's like, yes, yes, good. Oh.
Peter, what made you sigh with happiness?
I watched a movie called Robot Dreams, and it is a wordless animated movie, and it is just completely wonderful. It has a something for everyone, at least everyone on this podcast. So for Matt and Nick, it is set in early 1980s New York in the East Village, Lower East Side area predominantly. For Catherine, it's about robots. And for me, it's about a dog who is actually a person. So the gag in this movie is that it is, like I said, set in early 1980s New York, and it looks just like early 1980s New York, except, you know, in sort of a kind of indie cartoon format. And there's all of the scuzziness of it and the kind of delightful personalities on the streets, the punks, the CBGBs, all of the, you know, weird little stores and the grodiness of the subway and the people playing drums and all of that sort of thing. And the thing is that every single person, every single character in the movie is an animal whose name is their animal name. So the main character is just Dog, and Dog is sad and lonely and lives by himself in a little railroad apartment and watches TV late into the night until he sees a commercial for a mail order robot. He buys the mail order robot, puts it together, and he and robot become best friends. And they go to the beach and they do everything together and they're just best friends. And it's so wonderful and so cute until Mr. Robot gets left at the beach because he gets like rusted out or something in the ocean. And so Robot and Dog are separated throughout most of the movie. And it becomes this really kind of wonderful and gentle meditation on friendship and loss and starting over and what it means to actually be connected to another person, whether that person is a dog or a robot.
I want to note that this is a not dissimilar character arc to my current Dungeons & Dragons character.
No accident that.
Sorry.
I imagine. At the risk of inflaming some people who get agitated when you recommend or talk about flawed documentaries, I'm going to talk about and recommend to those who are interested in such things a, I think, 8-part Netflix series from 2022 called Ancient Apocalypse. Okay. This is a sumptuously—
Did the aliens do it?
—shot. What's that?
Did the aliens do it?
It
was
no.
The ancient aliens, right?
It's not about aliens. To cut to the chase that you only really get to in the 8th episode, Graham Hancock, who's this British journalist who is frequently derided as a pseudo-archaeologist, although he doesn't call himself an archaeologist because he's not. But he is always tilting windmills against the archaeology industry. And it's one of the many kind of irritating things about this series is that he won't stop talking about it. It's like, and then here's the finding that was too dangerous for archaeology to accept. And this is why archaeologists won't do this. And this is why they're suppressing this and that. It's an interesting window into a kind of semi-conspiratorial thinking, or also into someone who is frustrated by coming up against a received consensus that doesn't treat outsiders very well. And we can easily, all of us, imagine that there have been instances like this in the recent past. So it's fascinating. And it's also like they threw a ton of money at it. Apparently his son is one of the heads of Netflix or a production part of it. And he goes to various fascinating places where there's giant megaliths from 10,000 years ago at the end of the Ice Age that are kind of inexplicably there. This is like various sites in Turkey, Mexico, and other places. And he has a theory that you only get to towards the end, which is that at the end of the Ice Age, there's a gigantic comet storm that rained down and kind of triggered a catastrophic flood, that a lot of flood mythologies that we see in a lot of different cultures are associated with it, and that it wiped out a large amount of the civilization that came before, and that civilization was more advanced than we currently think. This is a sped up version of his kind of operational theory. It's a great documentary to watch while having your Wikipedia or your browser open, especially to like Skeptic magazine, because you'll see like he's constantly strawmanning the archaeology industry, sanding off the edges of possible dissenting opinions and promoting studies that have not remotely been replicated and have been all kinds of problems associated with it. And yet it's totally fascinating, and it activates people have called previously this sort of sense of wonder, right? Like you just look at this and go, wow. Places that I had no idea existed that probably Nick lived in at some point, the Serpent Mound in Ohio.
Oh.
Nick.
Yeah.
Incredible, like a mound that is made to look like a serpent, a snake with its mouth opened up and maybe swallowing an oval that could be the world. And it's all lined up with the summer solstice. And it's crazy. Like, what the hell? Doesn't make any sense at all. And a lot of these places don't really have a fully articulated theory about what has happened to them. The channeled scablands of Eastern Washington, which has been a disputed series of explanations trying to figure out what happened there. He's got one theory, other people have another one. But anyways, it's just sort of fascinating, and it's a perhaps unwitting meditation on the kind of Joe Roganification of treating of scientific and political subjects. And in fact, Joe Rogan is right there at the very end of it, sort of walking with Graham Hancock through, and he goes to all these different places and he's scuba diving and walking with him and saying, like, you know, why don't they want this information out there, kind of thing.
Why don't they, Matt?
The theory is just that it basically exposes their worldview up to now as being false. It exposes them as being, you know, that they're scared. They're scared, Nick, of the is exactly right. Who is they? No, it's like it's big archaeology. No, it's ridiculous. Like when you watch the thing through the relentlessness of that and also the lack of engagement with the people who are criticizing his and that worldviews, the comet hypothesis worldviews work is glaring and awful. And like it's not a trustworthy documentary. And yet it's totally fascinating. And you will learn stuff and you'll be excited to see things that you didn't know existed in the world. So really interesting. Eight-part series, Ancient Apocalypse. It's on Netflix. Don't believe it, but if you're interested in it, watch it and then do your own follow-up research on the side, and especially read Skeptic Magazine, because they don't like him at all, not even a little bit. All right, that's all the unlike that we have time for right now. Thank you for listening and watching. Nick, I understand that there's some events that you would like to promote in the near future.
Yeah. On April 15th in New York City, where once dogs and robot pets roam the streets, we have a great live interview with Jonathan Haidt. Go to reason.com/events to check that out. Tickets are going fast, and it is probably going to be sold out soon. So go to reason.com/events. And on May 8th, I'm going to be interviewing Kat Murty, who late of Cato, co-founder of Feminists for Liberty, who is also the new executive director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy at the Psychedelic Assembly in Midtown on May 8th. So check those out. We've got some good other stuff in the pipeline as well.
If you like our podcasts, or even if you don't, go look at them and check them out for yourself at reason.com/podcasts. It's the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, Just Asking Questions with Liz Wolf, Zach Weissmuller, and of course the Soho Forum series with Dr. Gene Epstein. And if you like what we do as an organization, this foundation, you can donate to us. Go to reason.com/donate to find out information about that. Thanks again, and we'll catch you next week. Goodbye.